do that a little bit more this morning. I hope you're excited about the book. I am. And the wisdom in it is incredible. And I wish you would pray for me, because just getting a handle around all that wisdom, because I ain't no Solomon. So sometimes it's really difficult to figure out what he's trying to say. And when you find it, you go, wow, I could have had a V8. And that's so obvious, but, you know, sometimes finding it is really a challenge. But I want to try to make sure that we get the big picture of Ecclesiastes. This is a quote from Donald Glenn. Donald Glenn, I believe, is a pastor at Dallas Seminary, or graduate of Dallas Seminary, with the Bible Knowledge Commentary, which I have found, both in teaching it about 18 years ago and again today, has got some of the most insight into the book, so I'll quote him quite a bit. But contrary to some people, I actually will give him credit and not try to plagiarize his work. So, they want to understand, here's something that he said. He says, the dominant mood of the book is pessimism. Would you believe that? Any of you ever just read the book through? Do you get a little bit down? If you're subject to depression, it should cheer you up. He was much worse than you are. But the you remember, what advantage did Solomon have? He had more knowledge and wisdom than anybody that ever lived. What other advantage did he have? Yeah. He was a king, yeah. You have any money? A little bit, yeah. When you use silver in your gardens, you know you have some money, right? When you have closets, cities for closets, ladies. 700 wives, 300 girlfriends. Too many wives, right, Anthony? How many is too many? Two. Anyway, two is the right answer, Anthony. For a guy that's been married, what, 63 years now? Yeah. Anthony has learned. You don't try to run her life, she doesn't try to run yours. All right. Here's what it says. But he was no pessimist, cynic or skeptic, as some critics have claimed. He was a believer who sought to destroy the people's confidence in their own efforts, their own abilities, their own righteousness, and to direct them to faith in God as the only possible basis for meaning. Value and significance to life under the sun. I want you to understand something about Solomon. Solomon has tried everything, and he's found what? Nothing works where? Under the sun. But he has found that there is potential life and enjoyment of life, but it takes a different perspective, and it has to be in the fear of God and the obedience and trust in Him. All right? Now, he continues. He wrote to combat the growing secularization. Now, remember, he's writing this in about 900 B.C., 950, 935, something like that. And he's got a problem with his religion. He's got something called what we call today modern secular humanism entering into religion. In other words, they're making the religion into something beyond what God had intended it to do. And life is indeed short, filled with enigmas, I love that word, and inequities. And apart from the assurance of future judgment, the future after death is dark and obscure. We need to know that God is going to call us to give an account of how we have spent our lives. Do you believe that? If you really believe that, what impact should that have? You better make sure you're living the way He wants you to live right now. Don't you think? Secular humanism. Do we have any of that in our society? Not really. We're a Christian nation. Any set of beliefs that promotes human values without specific allusion to religious doctrines. I want to cover... I found this quote was kind of interesting. Some Christians might be surprised to learn that they actually share some commitments with secular humanists. to reason, free inquiry, the separation of church and state, the ideal of freedom and moral education. However, we do differ in a few ways. Number one, belief in a deity, not necessary. If you're a secular humanist, you don't need God. In fact, most of them are atheists or agnostics. The difference between them, both A in the front of the word means no. So no theist would mean what? No God. And agnostic would be what? No knowledge of God. All right? Gnosticism is knowledge, or Gnostics is knowledge. So first thing in here that Solomon wants to counter is that there is a God. Does that make sense? Because the depression that he's through, the pessimism that he talks about, the vanity of vanities, all has to do with the fact of what's under the sun, down here on earth, the reality that we can't accomplish what we think we should without God. That's the whole point. Incarnations are the appearing of God, same as above us. There's no God, they don't appear. Origin of universe and life. Do we hear this in our society today? The scientific method. You remember when Rick Perry was running for president, they attacked him. What did they attack him on? On his whether or not he believed that God was a creator and that science didn't have all the answers. Do you remember that? That's going to be a test this time. You wait and see. You just watch. You attack people as that believe in evolution is somebody who's what? I'm sorry. Attack those who believe in creation. Excuse me. Stupid. Thank you, Tricia. Yeah. What else? Inept. Uneducated. Ignorant. Stupid. Loser. Narrow-minded. Yeah, well, he didn't say that, but Paul did. Yeah. That's right. All right. I thought you were going to say when Darwin came on the scene. You just don't need a tail anymore, huh? Well, the world philosophy is a secular humanist thought philosophy. If you're a Bible-believing Christian, you are weird. You are unique. As Peter would say, you are a peculiar people. All right? And you will be attacked for your beliefs. I don't mind telling you. I believe that God created the earth in 6 days, about 6,000 years ago. And I believe that that is biblically accurate. I also believe it's scientifically accurate. But secular humanists do not believe that. They think that the world has, and if you don't believe there's a God, you've got to go something to go to, right? If there is no God, how'd this thing start? And after death, after life, there is no after life. So they don't recognize an afterlife. So if you're a secular humanist and you don't believe there's a God and you don't believe you were created by God and you don't believe that he's shown up, what would be your philosophy about living your life? Anything goes, Barbara. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we will what? Die, exactly. Why evil? Why is there evil in the world? They have no concept of evil. You've heard this on your newscast because we need to evaluate it because it's because of their environment or their education, right? And that's why that little monster is evil. There's no rhyme or reason to why it's evil. There's no satanic power. There's no spiritual power at all. There's no evil. And so they tack it through sociology, psychology, criminology. Salvation. No salvation, no afterlife, no liberation or salvation. You need to achieve your potential. whatever that is. That's a popular subject, is it not? To reach your human potential. Social works and consciousness, ethical consciousness. I've never understood this. I want you to explain it to me. Any of you in here humanists? I just that would announce it, would acknowledge it. Right? Are you leaving yet? I'm sorry. I just Ed is our representative in Texas, huh? Would you explain to me, if there's no God, there's no evil, there's evil, but you don't really know where it came from, other than environments and education. There's no afterlife, there's no salvation. Why would you be concerned about ethics or morality? Does anybody understand that? Huh? No conscience? Okay. The undeserved suffering. How do we answer undeserved suffering? They say there's no spiritual reasons, but rather a matter of human vulnerability, misfortune, illness, and victimization. It just happens, right? Yeah, I'm not sure where it comes from, but yeah, Jim. Sin. Well, that would have some impact, right? Some, yeah. Yeah. In fact, I suspect you could probably say that's where it all comes from. And we say it's undeserved, and hopefully in our case it is, but it's one of the most difficult questions to answer. Job, of course, attack that. The contemporary issues, here's what they promote. See if any of these sound familiar. Elective abortion. Working for equality for homosexuals. Gender equality. I know of one candidate who's running for president that these are the issues that she espouses, but I won't tell you which one. Well, it could be Carly Fiorina, yeah, but I don't think so. Secular approach to divorce and remarriage. I don't know what that is. Working to end poverty, promoting peace and nonviolence, and environmental protection. You're going to hear more about environmental protection. Yes, Carl. Oh, luck. Okay. Okay. Bad. All right. You have problems because of bad luck. Sort of like the force be with you. Huh? Right. Dr. Glenn concludes this. However, in spite of this, life should not be abandoned or filled with despair. Rather, life should be lived in complete trust in God. That's what I want you to get out of this. Because I would tell you, from my perspective, that's one of the hardest things for us to do as Christians. Is to trust God in any circumstance. Talking to a person in here today, a very faithful person, about a job she asked for. And her response was, I didn't get it, and that must have been God's kindness and will for my life because of that. You know, sometimes the things that you want are not the best things to have. If any of you ever wanted something and then got it, and you said, I'd rather go back to the old one or whatever, I did the high school reunion. Ed, it's surprising you brought that up. I went to my 50th, the 50th, not my 50th. I don't go to mine. I don't like those people. My 50th. When I was growing up in the fourth grade, we moved to Crosby, Texas. I don't know if you know where that is. We lived on a cattle ranch, and I went to Crosby from the fourth grade to the seventh grade. Well, Crosby only had 60 in their 1965 graduating class, so they asked me to come. And I went. Couldn't get Leslie to go, but anyway. And I showed up, and I said, where did all these old people come from? And I'm walking around meeting Peter, and there is Shirley Heckler. Fourth grade. I said, Shirley, and her husband's back. I didn't know her husband's back there. You were my fourth grade girlfriend. I bet you didn't even know it, did you? She looked better than most of them. But anyway, you know, it's so much fun to go back and see your elementary school friends. You know, I went to a high school in Robert E. Lee in Baytown. I had 724 in my graduating class. So I don't even remember most of them, but it was such a big thing. Most of my friends were a year older, so that's why I don't go back to that one. But yeah, Doyle is here. And who else? Wanda Eichholz. Yeah, Doyle was not a high kicker, though, right? Wanda was. Yeah, Wanda was on the drill team. She's totally embarrassed. I bet neither one of you could do that today, but anyway. Yeah, I'm in trouble most weeks by the time I leave. I'm surprised anybody comes. In spite of this, life should not be abandoned. Should be lived in complete trust in God. Be received and enjoyed as a gift from His good hand. And be lived in the light of His future judgment. I don't want you to forget that. Solomon's going to teach us that a lot of things that we struggle with, and a lot of things we spend our lives trying to achieve, when you get there, it's what? It's vanity. It's worthless. It's pointless. It's meaningless. There's nothing there. And yet we spend all our time trying to achieve these things, when in reality, he's going to tell us that if you understand who God is and you trust and obey him, you can truly enjoy your life, and I would tell you, on a day-to-day basis. Yeah, Doug. Got it? Prologue. John Stossel. All right, so there was a debate between a humanist and a Christian. Oh, you couldn't answer their questions, huh? Well, don't miss class. Huh? Well, there are certain questions you just can't answer, aren't there? Define for me the Trinity. Huh? Where did God come from? Thank you, Anthony. Yeah. He's always been. That's what he says. He's eternal, Jim. Right. Who said that? Stossel. Is Stossel the unbeliever? Yeah. He's an agnostic. Yeah, he used to be a liberal too. Now he's a conservative. Maybe there's hope. Anyway. Huh? No, he's not liberal. I've heard. Yeah, he's libertarian. You don't have to worry about reality. You just get on high on drugs, right? Anyway, onward. Now, this is what we need to know and to do. Now, here is my theme for this book. You can only enjoy life by what? Trusting and obeying God. Now, how does the rubber meet the road there? Is that hard to do? Well, yeah, it's hard to do. Why? Because your circumstances are going to look one way and you can't really see what God is doing through those circumstances. All you can know is that God is working through your circumstances. All things work together for good to those who love God and are called according to His purpose. In other words, those things that come into our life that are sometimes devastating, like this Terry lady, I mean, and how bad that is, ultimately we can't see for years or decades what God had in mind for that. And sometimes we never see. We never understand. But what we know is who is we are putting our trust in. See, faith has an object. You know, trust and faith are one and the same. And faith is a three-part word. We are accused of Christians of blind faith. There is no such thing. Did you know that? Blind faith is the humanist. He's putting faith in what? Himself. His humanity, his abilities, etc. But Christianity believes in true biblical faith, the word pistis, from which we get the word pistuo, which is the word to believe. Pistis has three elements. What's the first one? Knowledge. You must know something. So it's inherent that as part of your faith, you must know something. For example, in Proverbs 3, 5, and 6, the scripture says, trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not on your own understanding, and all your ways acknowledge Him, and He will direct your paths. What does that say? Trust in the Lord with all your heart, based on His knowledge of His character and His being, and that He is a loving God. He is not an arbitrary or capricious God. He's not sitting there to get even with you. He is someone who loves you beyond anything you can imagine, and particularly if you're His, if you put your faith in Him. He is on your side, but there are certain things that happen in life. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. What does that tell you? Most of the time when you are in adversity, you will not see the benefit. It's only on the backside looking back. Right? I would tell you personally, on my 30th birthday, which was a few years ago, I had a meeting with three of my best people where they explained to me and said it would take 30 minutes. It took 5 hours. I got home after 11. Didn't skip the party Leslie had planned. And they said to me that I was absolutely the worst boss they had ever experienced. I don't know if you've ever had a kind of a aha moment like that. And they were graphic in their details, and I was absolutely devastated and depressed. I just thought God was done with me. I was a young Christian. I would have been a Christian for, 30th birthday, 2 years, 6 years at that point. Today, when I look back at that meeting, how do I look at it? Best thing that ever happened to me. You see, when you look at your circumstances, you've got to get to the place as a believer in Jesus Christ that you trust the one who says He loves and cares for you. That's where He wants you. He wants you to love Him with all your whole heart, soul, mind, and strength, and your neighbor as yourself. He wants you to love Him. But loving Him, Scripture says, faith, without faith it is impossible to please Him, because he who comes to Him must what? Believe that He is. Knowledge. Trust. Assent. And that He is a rewarder of those who diligently seek Him. You have to realize who He is and how He relates to you. You have to know that He cares about you more than you can ever imagine. I just see Him working on our behalf all the time to bring about things that we don't have a clue what's going on, and all we can think about is, woe is me. Oh, thanks, Noel. That is terrific. Yes. Because today, people teach you need faith in faith. If you just had more faith, I told you the story. When I had a partner in a coma for 19 months, from a brain disease. forgot what it's called now. No, it wasn't aneurysm. It was herpes encephalitis. And your brain swells. They drill holes in your skull to relieve the pressure. There was no cure for it until 6 months after he went into a coma. Liza Minnelli had it. And she was cured. He was not. He was in a coma for 19 months. And I remember, why, Lord? This is such a godly man. He's 43 at the time. Set medical records for being in a coma. People would call me 3, 4, 5, 10 a day. How is Bill? His wife was a lovely lady, Christian. Just could not answer the question. And when your faith is tested in why God would allow something like this to happen, and then somebody tells you why, it's an amazing thing. And all you can say is, praise you, Lord. You know exactly what you're doing and why you're doing it. And so, what Solomon wants us to know is this. All those things that you're relying on day after day to make you happy are going to be dust someday. Right? And he wants you to know this. You can truly live and love life today. But you've got to know that God is in charge. You've got to trust him. I didn't finish the faith. Faith has three components. Second one is what? Mental assent. You've got to say, that's a fact. I believe it to be true. And then the third thing is trust. All right? Use the example of the chair. When you sat in that chair, I didn't see anybody in this class look at it to see if it would hold you. And some of you, it would be a challenge. Right? And others don't have any problem. But you just did what? You just plopped. Yeah, I got eight legs on this chair. Thanks, Richard. Anyway, I pray it doesn't fall. Anyway, with that comment. But anyway, faith and believing. When Jesus said, believe in me and I'll give you eternal life, he said, I know who I am. You know who I am. Believe that it is me. Believe all it said about me and put your trust in me. And that's how you are saved. And these three things that came from Dwayne Garrett in the New American Commentary, he said, three conclusions to our mortality. All pretense of pride must be abandoned. In other words, there's nothing to really be proud of in ourselves. Life should be enjoyed for what it is, a gift from God, and one must revere God. Absolutely. And here's where it starts. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, the Koheleth. All, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Boy, is that depressing, huh? That's why so many people just happen to have a bad impact on the book. I told you last week, some of them didn't even think it ought to be in the Bible. It's so depressing. Vanity comes up 18 times in the book, according to the New American Standard, and the word is hebel, hebel. And it means emptiness or vanity, or figuratively, something transitory or unsatisfactory. So what he's going to be talking about when we read about vanity is when you accomplish it, whatever it is, and we'll look at what it is in a second. Whenever you do it, when you get to the end, it's what? Empty, worthless. Yes, Tammy. What is it? Smoke. Smoke, yes. And it's gone. It's just gone. And in fact, that's a really good point to lead into this point. The word means a breath, right? It's just, and it's gone. But what's eternal? What's eternal is the reality that God is eternal and we are eternal, and the things that God wants are what we need. Now, here are some of the things he's going to tell us is meaningless under the sun. Toil or labor. Wisdom can be. Righteousness. Wealth. Prestige. Pleasure. Youth and vigor. Life. Future after death. How many of these do most of us endeavor to get during our lifetime? Just about all of them at one point or the other. What would they eat? Okay, well, we're going to deal with that, Roger, because that's the subject of this morning. Apostle Paul said the same thing, and here's what the problem is. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it. In other words, who subjected the creation to futility? God himself. Why did he do it? Sin. Thank you. Good answers. But because of him who subjected hope that the creation itself also be set free from its slavery to corruption into the freedom of the glory of the children of God. When we struggle in life and when we see things that are unfair or unjust and we don't understand why things happen and we look at all of the, you know, you look at the Middle East and you look at ISIS and the beheading of babies and the crucifying of people and these things, and you wonder, why could these happen? Who would allow this to happen? In fact, that's probably one of the questions Stossel struggled with, right? Why are there so much evil in the world? And the answer is because we don't nuke them. Anyway, it's a... Yeah. Well, Jesus will when he comes back, let me assure you. I believe in love. For we know that the whole creation groans and suffers the pains of childbirth. So we're pictured as Hal right now. In childbirth. Is that fun, ladies? I've never been through it. It doesn't look too bad, but it's just Yeah, I should try it. Yeah. I tell everybody the story about when Aaron was born. I was in there with Leslie, and she was in labor. They didn't let me go in when Melanie was born. But Aaron was in labor, and I was watching Monday Night Football on the TV, and she's going, and I said, "This all right, dear?" And then I said, "You know, your mother's alone out there. I probably ought to go to stay with her for some." I got a quick answer to that one. Anyway, true, dear? Yeah, most of what I tell you is true. Anyway, the whole creation groans and suffers the pains of childbirth together until now. In other words, this whole creation is what? Struggling. It's in a death knell. There's no way ultimately for it to succeed. And he says this, and not only this, but also we ourselves, having the first fruits of the Spirit. Even ourselves, we groan within ourselves. Don't you groan at times from sin and inequity and pain? Waiting eagerly for the adoption of the sons and the redemption of our body. There is going to be a day when for us it is over. We call that the rapture of the church. And there's going to be a day when in an instant, in the twinkling of an eye, you are going to be transformed from what you are now into something good. Yeah. And something that is eternal and something without sin or pain or fear or crying or sorrow, and all of those things. I can't wait. So what does he take off on? Here's his first challenge. What advantage, profit or gain, does man have in all his work which he does under the sun? Are you an alcoholic? A workaholic? Are you admitting to it, Doug, or what? Yes, sir. Exactly. That's sort of a dichotomy. I mean, that's sort of a, I don't see it as either, but exactly right. If your whole focus is a lifetime of work to achieve something in the end, what does he say? Vanity. Under the sun. What does that mean? 29 times in the book, he's going to talk about that down here on earth. Yeah, Doug. I work to live, I don't live to work. Okay. Now, there came a point in my career where I said, because I was a workaholic at one time, you know, it's better to be than to do. It's better to be than to do. Well, I was a firstborn. Anybody in here firstborn? What stress did you have as a firstborn, John? Huh? You set the standard, right? Were there any expectations for you? Yes. And what were you supposed to be? Perfect. See, firstborn know that, right? So how did you get your approval of your parents? You were perfect, and you did better than anyone else, right? You set the bar high. And David, I realized at some point it was more important than who I was as a person as opposed to what I accomplished in my work. Does that help? Yeah. In other words, if you're always trying to accomplish in your work, at what point do you realize it's a waste? It's temporary. In other words, on one hand, as we'll see in a second, work is good, which is what Doug was saying. On the other hand, if you're a workaholic and all your life is geared towards your career and what you can achieve, you might be surprised in the end. That's what Solomon is saying. Job says this, is not man forced to labor on earth, and are not his days like the days of a hired man? As a slave who pants for the shade, and as a hired man who eagerly waits for his wages, so I am allotted months of vanity, and nights of trouble are appointed to me. The psalmist says this, as for the days of our life, they contain 70 years, or if due to strict, 80 years. Yet their pride is but labor and sorrow, for soon it is gone, and we fly away. These guys agreed, didn't they? If that's all you got in life, ultimately you're going to be disappointed when you get there. I had an amazing thing happen to me one time at work that might illustrate this point. My office manager had asked me to go over to the place where we store client records in a warehouse. Because the bill was getting so high, we needed to clean it out, throw away some files. So I went over there with her, and she would pull out these files, and what do we do with these? And I would say, I don't remember who that is. And she would pull out some more, and she said, well, you know who that was. And I said, oh, yeah, man, that was a big deal. I worked really hard on that. We had lots of problems. I struggled with that. That was frustrating. We finally got it done. She pulled another file. Mella, who was that? And she said, well, you remember them. She got a lot better memory than I do. But so what was the lesson I learned? I was always struggling with solving these problems, client problems. Some of them, a lot of them had criminal tax problems. And trying to figure out a way to help him or to do what was right or whatever, and it was just a struggle, and it was pressing and depressing and work and hard and long hours. 10 years later, can't even remember who they are. You prayed for my deposition the other day. The way I steel myself for a deposition is in a week you'll forget what it was all about. And it's true. You will. You won't even remember. Unless you really blow it up. So, if work is your goal, what is it ultimately going to get you? Well, it might get you some money. It might get you to feed your family. There are a lot of good things about it. But if you're just depending on that work, what does it get you? Temporal gain. Thank you. A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. That's his explanation of work. Why would he say that? A generation goes and a generation comes. You're going to work real hard and then what? Die. Isn't that encouraging? A generation comes, a generation goes, but the earth remains forever. What is he saying? It's temporary. The earth is permanent. Are you trusting your worth to ultimately satisfy and reward you? Conclusion, if you're depending on it, it will yield nothing because it's temporary while the earth is permanent. Now watch this. Ecclesiastes 1:5-7. Also the sun rises and the sun sets. I think that's a positive thing when I get up in the morning. Don't you? How many of you rely on the sun coming up? All right. And hastening to its place, it rises there again. Blowing toward the south, then heading toward the north, the wind continues swirling along, and on its circular courses, the wind returns. All the rivers flow into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place where rivers flow, they flow again. What is he talking about in regard to work? Huh? I'm sorry, David. Endless, endless. The fist in a bucket of water, okay? What's going on here? Why would he say and use this example about work? It's not what, Barbara? It's not as important as you think it is, all right? It's never satisfied. It never does what? It never achieves anything, right? So, yes, Doug. Here's what Bible Knowledge Commentary says. The second fact Solomon cited in support of his effectiveness, or his thesis in effectiveness of labor, is nature's ceaseless activity. Mere activity in itself produces nothing of ultimate value. In other words, the sun is constantly, and the moon are constantly what? They're coming up, going down, but they never what? That's all they do. They just come up. So, and then he says, the sun and the wind are in constant motion, but it never arrive at any fixed goal or lasting rest, and the sea is never full. Now, I may not get to it today, so if you're not here, when I do get to it, I want you to know something. This passage right here is an amazing passage for what it talks about the inerrancy of the Word of God. Why would that be? Do you know what he's just described centuries before anybody ever understood it? The hydrological cycle, right? And the Gulf Stream winds. The winds blow along, and I have at the end, I'm not going to get to it today, but I have at the end, where it just constantly, the water goes up into the sky, forms clouds, the clouds rain, as we experienced last night and the night before, and it rains, and the water goes back into the lake, and then what? And the sea never what? Never fills. Doug? He's always there. He's always there. But that is a great example of the fact that the Bible is scientifically accurate when it speaks to science. Randy? Okay. Yeah, Randy said the top five answers of people who are dying, what would you change, right? What would you change? I would work less. Sounds good to me. I still work, though. Yeah. Jim? Yeah, when he decides to it in. Yes, it will. I want you to notice, the earth is working. Oh, I'm sorry. They'll tell you if you're not. Okay, yeah. They're like that. Right. Right. And that's exactly right. I just hadn't got there yet. You're just ahead of me. Huh? They have their own business. Yeah, and look, I hadn't gotten to the good part. In fact, you'll have to come back probably next week to get to the good part. Because, by the way, in the same book, he talks about the good part. All right? But what are we trying to say right now? If your life is totally devoted to your career and your work to the exclusion of others, and to the exclusion of yourself. You're wearing yourself out. When you get there to the end, you're going to say what? I wish I worked less, right? See, I know I've been on both ends of the spectrum. I was a classic workaholic. Yes, Roger. Climb the ladder till you find it's leaning against the long wall. Notice that there is never any real rest. The sun and the moon, they just keep doing it, don't they? And I'm glad they do. In fact, that's also evidence that there is a God by the fact that they are, you know, they can tell you where a star was thousands of years ago, right? Same place. The sun and the moon are moving in circles, and the sea is never full. What futility. Yes, Doug. Mm-hmm. Finish the race. Yeah. Yeah. Kyle. Always had something to do. Work always expands to fill the time. Isn't that what they say? Yeah. Thank you. Here's the futility. Cursed is the ground because of you. So we can blame Adam. In toil you eat, well, probably Eve first, but well, that's what Adam said, right? In toil you will eat of it all the days of your life. Both thorn and thistles it shall grow for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you will eat bread till you return to the ground, because from it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. Why is work futile? I'm going to save this for next time. Any questions or comments? God bless your week. Remember Jim and Ken this week. See you next week. Hi, Roma. How are you doing? Love you. Missed you.